Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Welcome everybody to the last, yeah I know, but it is, the last motorsport podcast of 2010. A very happy Christmas to all of you. Hope you have a great time, and also congratulations of course to Sebastian Vettel, the new world champion, and to Red Bull for taking the Constructors' Championship. Two championships in one season for Red Bull. A fantastic year. The right man won, Nigel? Yes? No?
Certainly the right car won, without any question. I mean, it was, you know, it's a long, God knows how many years since I can remember a car that was that much quantifiably better than its opposition. I'm sort of, slightly equivocal about it. I mean, Vettel is an absolutely fantastic driver, and he's going to be one of the all-time greats, without a doubt. I guess I would have preferred to see Mark Webber win it, because Mark is 12 years older, and he may never get another chance. You can see Vettel getting a hatful of titles.
What are your reservations and about, I think, about Vettel?
I mean, my reservations about Vettel? None really. I think we saw, oddly enough, I think we started to see the old Vettel again towards the end of the season. I think we'd all started to tire rather of the sort of bad-tempered kid we sometimes saw, and I know very much, certainly the team sometimes got tired of the bad-tempered kid. But you know, he's an absolutely, he's just a brilliant natural talent. I still believe that Alonso is the most complete driver in Formula One, and I don't see anything on the immediate horizon that's going to change that. But I honestly think, you know, any one of those four who went to Abu Dhabi would have been a worthy world champion in 2010.
Damien, the editor's view.
It would have been quite an own goal if a Red Bull driver hadn't won the championship, because you know they did have the fastest car. Having said that, you can't take it away from Sebastian, because over the last quarter of the season, he was the man to beat, and he was the quickest driver out there. I think there were a few mistakes this year where he could have thrown it away easily, and we thought he had thrown it away. I think after Spa, when he hit Jensen Button that time, I think it looked like he was going to blow it, and I think he deserves credit for recovering from that. Because I think mentally he must have been a long way down after that race. So I think he deserves it. But I agree with Nigel. There's any one of those four would have deserved it had it fallen differently in Abu Dhabi.
Interesting. Okay. Well, he is the 2010 world champion. So congratulations to every single person at Red Bull up there in Milton Keynes in England. Terrific season. Let's look back at it then, shall we? Let's look back at the season as a whole. We are talking to you today from our local pub, which is called The Ram in Chelsea in London, down by the river. So thanks to The Ram for having us. And we are going to have a look back on what surely has been, if not the most, one of the most exciting seasons of Grand Prix racing ever. And to guide us through this, we have our veteran Grand Prix writer, Nigel Roebuck, a man of huge experience. And as PJ O'Rourke was always telling us, age and experience sure as hell beat a new haircut. We also have with us our esteemed editor, Damien Smith, who has chosen our topics for today, as he rightly should. And of course, Ed Foster, who looks after everything to do with our pods and the casting of them. So, let's begin with Vettel and Webber. Surely one of the talking points of the season. Was it an inconvenient truth, this partnership? Well, Webber even said that himself. The team with the quickest car expected its young superstar to be the number one this year, didn't it? But it was the 30-something Aussie who led the championship right through the summer, not 23-year-old Vettel. This was not in the Red Bull script, and team boss Christian Horner had a tough job improvising as the story got, well, stickier and stickier, particularly at the twin peaks of Istanbul and Silverstone. Was it an inconvenient truth, this partnership? Nigel Roebuck.
I think to a degree, yes. Occasionally you get a situation where there is a team and it's perceived that the team has a driver and the other guy is always the other driver. I think we were all aware of it, for instance, in the McLaren era when Häkkinen was there with Coulthard. We were certainly aware of it in the Schumacher-Ferrari era, no matter who his teammate was. And I don't think, in the case of Red Bull, it's maybe it's certainly not as overt as Ferrari was in those days. But, I mean, like it or not, you know, there are reasons why Vettel could be considered the favoured one. He was brought on by Helmut Marko, you know, from way, way back, from being a kid. He's young, he's German-speaking, Red Bull is an Austrian company, and he's, you know, he's going to be around, he's going to be driving for that team probably for a long, long time. Mark Webber, on the other hand, is getting into his mid-30s, and he's had a completely different... I hate to use the word journey, God help me, to where he is now, in the sense that I think there's a perception that Vettel, to some degree, has had it easy. Of course, you've got to be able to do the job. But he was brought on and brought on and brought on, and everything was, we've gone to the next step, the next step, the next step, everything was paid for. And it was all quite seamless and quite straightforward. And, of course, he had this fantastic talent, fundamental talent. Mm-hmm. Whereas Mark, you know, had none of that. So Mark has fought and grafted, you know, every step of the way. And I don't think that's... I'm not making out... I'm not saying that in a sort of, forgive me, a Graham Hill sense of the word, because I think Mark's natural talent is very high, which I never thought Graham Hill's was particularly. I thought Graham did it with hard work and admirable in itself. Mark has had to do the hard work. But I think he has always been his talent level is very high.
But I think after the Webber's last year before Vettel came into Red Bull, he had had a slightly sort of poor end to the season, and poor season that year. And I think everyone slightly perceived Vettel just to blow him away, apart from Webber.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, and of course they didn't get off on the greatest step, those two, did they? When was it Shanghai, where running behind the pace car when Mark was running second and Sebastian was right behind him and ran into the back of him behind the safety car, both out on the spot. So I think that was the first time Mark was moved to make remarks about this is like Mario wishes to say, you know, in those situations, it's what happens when you have a boy trying to do a man's job.
the thing about Mark Webber, though, is that he always dominated his teammates, and every team he was in,
yeah,
he would psychologically get on top of them very early on and would put them in their place. And I think this time it's been harder for him because he's come up against someone who is top class. It's noticeable that early in the season, when Mark was actually putting in great performances against Sebastian, was outpacing him. I think he used that within the team psychologically to put more pressure on Sebastian by saying to him, hey mate, you know, you're supposed to be the wonder kid and I'm, you know, here's me beating you, what's going on? You know, just putting questions in Sebastian's head the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't even have to say it.
No.
You know, he was at a race like Monte Carlo, for instance, you know, the one everyone wants. I don't know how many safety cars we had that afternoon, but it was a good few. And every time they restarted, Mark just calmly disappeared again. And I certainly, at that stage, had the impression Vettel was a bit nonplussed. Because
yeah,
he is one of those drivers who, you know, if somebody's quicker than he is in the same car, fundamentally there's something wrong.
But he was, wasn't he complaining about having a chassis problem for that sort of mid part of the year?
Yeah,
he was. I mean, how much truth was in that? Was that an excuse?
There may well have been some, you know, some validity to it. I can't comment further on that. I think my feeling about Mark is when Mark is really on it, he's almost unbeatable. And sort of Spain and Monaco and Silverstone, it's quite hard to imagine Mark getting beaten, you know, in any of those three races this year. Hungary was a slightly different win, but
the same was true of Sebastian and Suzuka, and
yep, absolutely,
and in Brazil, really,
absolutely.
So, I think, you know, they say about the new Schumacher thing, which is a little bit glib as a line to use about him, but I think there are some parallels to early Schumacher in terms of Schumacher's Benetton days, where he would you could see the quality and the talent there, but he would make big mistakes in racecraft. He would upset other drivers. He didn't like losing. All these things we see in Sebastian, there are some parallels there.
I mean, some of the moves that he pulled off on, you know, a lot of the starting grids and just chopping across was, you know, they should have been picked up on, I think, definitely.
Yeah, particularly Hockenheim.
Yeah.
Because, in fact, that was what led to all the controversy in Germany, because he chopped across Alonso so outrageously that, all it did was delay both of them, which allowed Massa to snick round the outside of the pair of them and take the lead, which of course led to the team orders controversy later on.
One thing,
but that behaving like that, whether it's not just Vettel, any of them behaving like that, that has come from Michael Schumacher, no question. Yeah. He patented it.
And Senna a bit, I think.
Yeah, but Senna away from a grid was not as overt as that.
But how do we think Christian Horner handled the management of the two drivers, because he had a very difficult situation. He had Helmut Marko in one corner, who's got Dietrich Mateschitz's ear, you know, backing Vettel to the hilt. Weber lifting his level of performance beyond what anyone expected to.
I think with Christian, it was sort of a situation of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You know, when you've got two drivers that, like Weber and Vettel, have just been on it this year, and a car that's comfortably quicker than every other car on the grid, if you know, any mistakes, everyone is going to start screaming at you, saying, you know, well, this happened, but just because you're in the limelight and everyone feels that there are no excuses if your car's that fast, then why aren't you winning every Grand Prix, which isn't Grand Prix racing? So I think he's done very well considering the situation he's had. And, you know, I mean, both of them are quite spiky characters, and Weber, you know, come across the radio and, you know, not bad for number two driver, and, you know, things like that didn't sort of really help him too much. But no, I think he's done a good job. And, you know, we do forget that a lot of the other team principals are much older, with them a lot more experience. And really, before he came into Formula One, he'd been sort of, you know, done to Arden and things like that, but not compared to all the other guys on the grid.
I think, I mean, what strikes me is the... You think of Red Bull this season, of course you think of races both drivers have conclusively won, dominated, but you also think of one that was tossed away, which was Istanbul. And I think it's quite easy for the outside world to understand why Weber has this perception that, you know, the team is fundamentally supporting the other guy, because in the aftermath of that accident, and to me, anybody with eyes in their head could see that accident was caused by Vettel, because he turned, he was alongside Mark, he drew slightly ahead of him, and then he turned right before he cleared him, and that was the end of it. And there was no argument. I mean, you can see at the shot when the two cars are coming towards you, it's beyond plain. And yet, despite that, Helmut Marko blamed Weber for the accident, and I think, well, A, was an idiotic thing to say, but more to the point, of course, it spawned this perception that, they are on Vettel's side, aren't they?
And then there was the new front wing at Silverstone, which, I think was probably Christian Horner's only big mistake of the year, in my view.
Yeah.
I think if he could have his time again, he wouldn't have done that. I don't know, because I haven't asked him, but I suspect that is the case. And also, I think, Nigel, you had it absolutely spot on a few minutes ago when you described why Vettel is you know, is very obviously the favoured son at Red Bull. I mean, how can there be any argument over this? You know, I mean, why would he not be? Is my question.
Yeah, I think that's the, you know, that's how it feels to me. Just like it always felt the same to me in the McLaren days with Hakkinen and Coulthard. It wasn't that anybody was antagonistic towards DC. And nor was it the fact that, you know, Mika had better equipment than David. It just wasn't like that. And David himself always believed, quite rightly, I think, that he had exactly what Mika had. But it was just the way he felt within the team. And there was one particular occasion when David told me about when he had got pole, and right at the end of the session, Mika beat it. And he was dismayed by the reaction by a lot of the people in the team.
Let's move on then to Ferrari. Can't talk about a Grand Prix season without Ferrari, my goodness. Was it a team order of merit, you know, that team order? The biggest point of controversy in 2010, the not very coded message to Massa at Hockenheim to give the win to new Ferrari teammate Alonso. The tabloid newspaper screamed, of course, the fan forums frothed, and the FIA punished a clear breach of the rules with a modest fine. Was that because the governing body knew its rule banning team orders was unworkable, or did Ferrari get away with the crime of the season? Damien, what was your take on it?
It's been talked about so much, hasn't it? I still think... huge overreaction, and I understand why there was a big overreaction, and none of us want to see it happen, but what were they to do? Massa was never going to win the world championship this year, the way he was driving, the form he was in. Okay, Hockenheim, he drove very well, but he was in the lead because of the circumstances at the start between Vettel and Alonso. The reality was that Alonso was the guy that could take the fight to McLaren and to Red Bull. This whole rule has never worked properly, and
well, you can't enforce it, can you? I mean, it's not a rule that you can write it down, but you know you can't tell what the teams are ordering their drivers to do. Just a simple code, and that's thrown out the window
until you can read people's minds.
Also, wasn't it more? I thought it was more because it was so early in the season that everybody made such a fuss about it.
Well, in part it was because of that, but. You know, some people appear to be unaware of the fact that it was only the Schumacher-Barrichello scandal in Austria, and to my mind that was a scandal. That was literally a guy moving over 20 feet before the line on strict instructions to let a guy win who already had an enormous lead in the World Championship comparatively early in the season. So that really was... just, you know, beyond the pale.
Yeah.
I think in this situation was entirely different. If you look back to the circumstances of Hockenheim, Ferrari had had a terrible run, both of poor reliability and bad luck and mistakes and whatnot. And they were, you know, effectively sort of out of the championship hunt. And to me, it was no more than common sense to conclude that, well, with the best win in the world, you know, Massa just... ain't going to do it. If we are going to have a world champion this year, it can only be Alonso. In that particular race, as I say, if it hadn't been for Vettel's messing about at the start, Alonso would have been ahead of Massa from the beginning anyway. So I think Ferrari always said, you know, at Ferrari, the team always comes first. Yeah. And the strange thing is, all these people who built this great hue and cry about... you know, oh, it's dreadful and it shouldn't happen and all the rest of it. No, of course, it's something you want to see happen. But, you know, Ferrari, neither Ferrari nor McLaren nor Red Bull nor anybody are doing this to provide entertainment for the public. They're doing this to win. It's a serious business. It's not a serious endeavour. It's not a game. So I think you know, they were entirely justified in doing what they're doing. Team orders have always, always been part of Formula One. Except and it, they had they not been, Mike Hawthorn and John Surtees would never have been world champions.
No, except they broke the rule and they were taken to court for breaking the rule.
Yeah, quite rightly.
No, but then they weren't really punished, were they?
Not when you look back at the McLaren fine.
No, certainly not as much as Max Mosley, who he would have wished.
But that was out of...
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The stratosphere anyway, wasn't
it? Well, it was.
In terms of punishments, there was no precedent for a fine that big. It's going to be always seen as a one-off, hopefully.
Yeah.
But what does it say to everybody else? If you break the rule, you go to court, and then you're basically, to all intents and purposes, you're let off pretty much. Okay, a few thousand, whatever it was. But
I think it's because they realise the rule is so unworkable. I mean, that's got to have something to do with it, because if it's just a standard breaking of the rules, then fine. But the fact that they know they can't enforce it, they know that other teams are doing it. You know, if they set a huge fine, Ferrari is going to say, well, you know, all these guys are doing, they're just using code. Why aren't you finding them? You should be finding them. And the mistake that Ferrari made was to not rein in Rob Smedley and tell him what to say. And that was the mistake they made. It wasn't breaking the rules because everyone's doing it.
Ferrari being too honest about something.
That's a new one.
And Max Mosley being against them, which is also a new one.
Yeah. But one thing that we can rule out is that this wasn't a case of Ferrari favouritism by the FIA, because Jean Todt is no great lover of Ferrari these days, is he? You know, no. That love affair is long over.
Yeah.
I have to say, the saddest thing to come out of it, though, is what it's obviously done to Felipe mentally, because the second half of the season, he's just dropped away.
But he wasn't great in the first half of the season.
Well, he had some good drives, considering he was coming back from a head injury, but it's just since then it's really tumbled.
Well, you know, Brazil was a case in point. You know, he'd never in Brazil in a Ferrari started from other than pole position until this year.
I take the opposite view. I think the result was very good in the sense that we had Alonso fighting for the world championship, made it much more exciting.
No, absolutely, but on the other hand, I mean, there had been all this suggestion that, you know, Massa was going to step up to the plate and help him, as he did Kimi Raikkonen 3 years ago. You know, now explain that to me. He let Raikkonen by to win the world championship in 07, and as I recall, not a word of criticism came anybody's way.
Because it was the last race, I suppose. People think there's a different rule for the last race. It's not written, is it?
No, there probably wasn't a radio message either.
No.
It's probably just implicit, you know, as it was with Rubens Barrichello all those years with Michael.
If you were ever going to have a season where team orders was a regular occurrence, surely this is going to be it, isn't it? 2010. I mean, look at the people at the top of the championship. What are they going to do? They can't have two people winning the world championship.
I think it was also, as we were saying, but it's the fact that mathematically, Hockenheim both can still win the world championship. But you know, it's a sensible decision. But it's when both drivers can still win that, you know, it obviously goes down a lot worse.
Well, I think you've got to, you know, look to 1986 when Williams had clearly, incomparably, the fastest car, much as Red Bull have had, and both drivers, Piquet and Mansell, both in with a strong shot at the championship, and then the two of them went to the last race together with Prost, and we know what happened, don't we? Prost won.
And it was extremely exciting.
It was extremely exciting. And actually, I still think of that as the last year when we had a world champion in other than the best car.
Let's move on. Button versus Hamilton at McLaren. The perfect team? Well, at first we wondered if it would be a rerun of Prost and Senna. The reality was more Hill against Clark at Lotus. Two British world champions who got on well together, paired in Britain's most famous team. The combination of intelligent, super smooth, at ease with himself Button and tough, super fast, edgy Hamilton worked well for Martin Whitmarsh's McLaren, and not just for the marketing department either. Damien, it was all a bit strange to begin with, wasn't it, seeing two drivers getting on so well together?
Yes, I mean, I guess everyone probably rubbed their hands at the prospect of what could be coming up when you've got, you know, the reigning world champion coming into the team. Everyone said, is he mad? It's Lewis's team. You know what sort of tough character Lewis is to work with. He, you know, we thought this was going to be fireworks, but of course what we didn't take into account was that the Jensen is just incredibly at ease with himself, very confident. He knows who he is, what he's capable of, and he wasn't going to be rattled by the fact that he knew going in that Lewis was going to be quicker on occasion, that probably on more occasions than not Lewis would set the pace in qualifying. Jensen isn't a great qualifier, but he was, I think, coming off the back of the championship with Brawn last year, he was just ready for something else. Clearly something went wrong there with Ross Brawn, which has never been fully explained in public. He was ready for the change, and he fitted into McLaren so well. And they love him because he's such a easy guy to work with. And I don't think he's always been given enough credit for his work ethic behind the scenes. Mechanics love him, the engineers love him. And it turned out to be a very good mix, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we were saying possibly, I mean, I must confess, I was one of those who thought, God, Jensen, what, you know, is this a good idea? When he did what he did, of course, it turns out that it was an extremely good idea. But I think when we were looking ahead and seeing possibly a Prost-Senna situation, we were looking at it in terms of driving and results, as well as, you know, rather than more than, you know, in terms of personalities. And in point of fact, I think as far as driving is concerned and what they've achieved this year, it's been remarkably like Prost and Senna. The difference being that, you know, that Lewis and Jensen get along well. I think, you know, Jensen's victories in the early part of the year, they were classic Prost sort of wins. I've always looked upon Jensen as a sort of lesser Prost. It's not to denigrate him at all, because I think Prost is one of the very greatest of all time. But I think in many, many ways they're very similar, smooth driving style and everything else. But I think Lewis has benefited hugely from Jensen's presence, and admits it himself, not least in terms of what to say, how to behave. You know, it's been a sea change this year. Lewis has been without his father, and with Jensen, and I mean, there's no question about it. Lewis has been a much, much looser, you know, more relaxed individual this year than any time I've ever seen him in the past.
The thing that's really surprised me is just how badly Button has qualified this year, especially towards the end of the season. I mean,
look how he qualified at the end of last season.
Yeah, but I don't
when the World Championship was back. Yeah,
I don't get it. I don't understand what's going on here. I mean, why can't he qualify properly?
I think recently the car, he hasn't been very happy with the car, and Button's one of those drivers who has quite a small window in which he gets the maximum out of it, and if everything's suited to him, he will go out there and he'll be unbeatable. But with the McLaren, I don't think that's quite been the case especially the second half of the season. And Lewis is well known for getting out there and wringing the car's neck and getting performance out of it that shouldn't be there, and I think that's why he's made, you know, a couple of mistakes later on in the season. Just because, you know, he's got to drive beyond the car's limits.
And there's one thing that, Nigel, you've mentioned a couple of times, a comparison to the past again, Lewis and Gilles Villeneuve, in the sense that he's absolutely flat out the whole time.
Absolutely.
And there's no compromise with
him. No, absolutely.
Which I think is a great thing about Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, in fact, we talked about Prost Senna, we've talked about Hill Clark as comparisons with this. You could also make a case for saying Villeneuve Gilles Villeneuve and Jody Scheckter.
Yeah.
Very similar.
But on the other hand, I hear what you're all saying about this, about Button, but I mean, he puts himself on the back foot so badly with this poor qualifying, doesn't he? In the sense that nowadays, if you're not at the front of the grid, you're not going to win the race.
No, that's true. Although, no, you're not. That is right. And it's remarkable, actually, the number of times Jensen comes through very strongly on race day, as he did on, you know, in Brazil. And for that matter, as he did in Brazil last year, the day he won the World Championship. And so you think, well, hell, you know, why the hell, if you can do this today, why, you know, where were you yesterday? I think perhaps, you know, a surprise has been in that, particularly in the second half of the season. If you think about it, mid-season, Lewis Hamilton was handily in the lead of the championship. And I guess I've probably been surprised in the second half of the season that, while Ferrari have, in several instances, discernibly closed the gap to Red Bull, McLaren don't really seem to have progressed. And we've become accustomed to both drivers moaning about their car's competitiveness, you know, the extent that Ron Dennis was moved to say that he'd had enough of it. So that's been a surprise.
So much so, in fact, Nigel, that, you know, in the last few races of the season, the little bits of Pit Sky Radio we managed to hear were almost invariably Jenson Button or Lewis Hamilton telling us that how bad the car was.
Yeah, I mean, in Brazil, Lewis sort of just sounded out of sorts, didn't he? The whole race, sort of downbeaten and generally fed up. You know, haven't got any grip. Is the F duck really working?
Is any of this because they build a car for Hamilton, which Button has to drive, or not?
No, I don't think it's that. No, I don't think it's that. I mean, I think probably the biggest single difference between the two is, as you said, Jensen needs the car to be right. And of course, all drivers in a perfect world want that, but Lewis can do more with a car that's not working well.
Moving on then to Michael Schumacher, obviously a talking point of this season. Return of the King is what we said on the cover of Motorsport magazine in April. Oh dear. As comebacks go, it was a disaster. But there were green shoots towards the end of the season. Was Schumacher finally getting a handle on Formula One after 3 years away? Maybe. And it might bode for better things next season. Whatever, his poor form in 2010 must have hurt him. And it certainly hurt Mercedes-Benz in the pocket, if nowhere else. Nigel, not the world's greatest fan of Michael Schumacher, so let's start with you.
No, you are right, Rob. That's not to suggest that I ever thought he was other than a fantastically skilled Grand Prix driver. But the Barrichello incident in Hungary illustrated perfectly why I've never been a fan. I think as far as this year is concerned, what I've personally grown a bit weary of was hearing from Michael himself, but also from, it seemed like, everybody around him, Mercedes people and even Ross to some degree. You know, this endless thing about Michael can't get on with these front tires. Now, my first thought about that was, I remember interviewing Ross 8-9 years ago and saying to him at one point, what is the difference between Michael and the rest? And Ross immediately said, it's what Michael can do in adversity. It's what Michael can do with a bad car. And no question about it. I mean, he absolutely believed that. And at one time, that may well have been the case. But I think it's a bit poor and a bit flimsy to sort of say, well, poor old Michael can't get on with these front tyres. And I was interested to see the other week, Alan Prost said, he said, well, that's obviously, that's just an excuse. There's no other word for it. Because he said the thing about Schumacher was he could always adapt to anything.
Yeah. One thing I would say was when we had Damon Hill in for the podcast, he said, you know, when you come back and, you know, at that age, and you've been out of the sport for that period of time, what he's not going to be able to do when he comes back is drive by the seat of his pants. That, you know, driving on the edge and being able to do that. He said he won't be able to do that, and it will probably frustrate him, and he might well be off the pace because of it. And so I suppose that's, you know, but I don't, but I still think, you know, Damien and I were talking about it earlier, that I think there is more to come from him, definitely. And
there is, but the thing is about Michael Schumacher is this: in 2010, he was coming back into a Formula One that's been far more competitive than probably any other era. I mean, you think about when Niki Lauda came back in. Okay, he's coming back in with turbo cars, which were very different to the ground effect cars he left Formula One in. So again, he had a big technical change. But I would say that comparatively, the competitive level of Formula One has gone up hugely since those days.
Yeah,
and you've got more top drivers now who are at the top level of their game. You know, we've had five drivers fighting for the world championship this year, plus Felipe Massa, plus Nico Rosberg, who deserves a lot of credit for what he's been doing at Mercedes.
And Kubica.
And Kubica, we can't forget him. But it's
that,
harder.
That really that can't be said enough. I don't think. I think it seems to me it remarkable in a way. You know, Nico has somehow been barely noticed this season. Somehow, here we are. We are not talking about Mercedes. We're talking about Michael Schumacher. And Nico has comprehensively annihilated him.
I don't get about it. Sorry.
Nico's not had the best of luck this year. But I mean, I think he's had a tremendously good season, and I think it's been vastly underrated and overlooked.
I think it's just there's so much going on, isn't there? But ahead of them, that's probably part of the reason why.
It's true.
Also, Nico Rosberg seems to me to go about his business with a singular lack of drama and controversy, and therefore he's not really of that much interest to most sections of the media.
Well, people might say that of Jensen.
Except that Jensen's at McLaren, which is publicity mad, marketing mad. Jensen is in the papers with his girlfriend.
I don't think they like publicity at Mercedes.
I do, Nicky, actually, yes. In fact, I know they do, but maybe not that. Maybe they don't feel this is perhaps the best publicity they could be attracting. What I don't get, maybe someone can help me here. So many top racing drivers have told me over the years that you do not forget how to do it. The great guys, they don't just forget how to do it. So this is what I don't understand.
You don't forget, but there is no way that you can perform at the same level for how many years it is and still at the age of 41 in Formula One. Or whatever anyone says, he hasn't forgotten how to do it, in as much as if one of us went into a Formula One car, we'd be, you know, we wouldn't be able to get heat in the tyres. You know, he hasn't forgotten how to drive a Formula One car, but it's just that edge that I think has gone, just faded a little.
I'll confess, when I interviewed Alonso and we started talking about Michael, pretty well everybody I've spoken to this year about Michael has said the same thing. Well, you know, he's 41, you know, life changes, the cars are different and the tyres are different, and you can't expect to just come back. And Fernando is adamant that if the car is, the Mercedes is decent next year, and the tyres that suit him.
You bet.
He will be right back.
You bet.
And he's, there aren't many people who say that.
Well,
I was just fascinated that Alonso did.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
I'd go along with that. I'd never discount the bloke. Never, ever, ever.
And it comes down, you know, Formula One comes down to having the right car, doesn't it? We saw it last year with the Brawn coming out of the traps with a double diffuser, which gave Jensen the chance to do the business. If Mercedes-Benz come up with something for next year, and there's no reason to suggest they won't, then if he's got a car advantage, Michael will be right there.
Yep.
If he's got a car advantage, yeah.
Hmm.
Which, of course, he did have for the great bulk of his Formula One career.
Well, I suppose going on what Nigel's been telling us, what would be interesting were they to have the Red Bull equivalent, say, next in 2011, then what would be really interesting would be to see who did best, Rosberg or Schumacher.
Yeah, I'd take Rosberg.
I would probably take Rosberg, actually. I think, you know, we shouldn't be previewing 2011 just yet, but I think Schumacher will get back to a level where he could possibly still win races, but I do wonder now over a season whether he's got it in him for another championship challenge, having seen what we've seen this year. And I think I agree with Nigel that Nico is hugely underrated and has the chance to blossom. And I'm pretty sure that with Mercedes resources, Ross Brawn at the helm, and the team coming off the back of a bad season, where they've had time to look at the next car, that we'll see a change completely for next year, and the Mercedes will be much more competitive than they have been this year.
Well, no, I just want to close on that very briefly indeed by saying that my bloggers will know that in my New Year predictions I predicted that Michael Schumacher would win a race this season.
It's another good prediction of yours.
Oh dear.
That and Kimi Räikkönen would come back to Formula 1
having won the World Rally Championship. Yeah.
Thank you. Shall we move on? May I move on with the permission of the editor?
I think we should move on.
Thank you. Do you want to know one prediction I have for 2011? You don't, do you? Webber will beat Ferrari. Okay, I've said it.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best in motor racing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.